Welcome to Lives, a show exploring our experiences in the world and how we might live well. I'm Stuart Chittenden, and my guest today is Autumn Pruitt, the founder of Hardy Coffee Co. We talk about the vision Pruitt has for Hardy Coffee as a source of rhythm and ritual in people's lives. Pruitt shares her entrepreneurial journey, the lessons and experiences encountered on the way, and how, like the business, she has grown to meet that aspiration.
It's hard not to lead with, "Hello, I'm Autumn Pruitt. I'm the founder and owner of Hardy Coffee Company." But also understanding, like, if that wasn't in my Instagram bio, that I would still be Autumn Pruitt. I just would be doing something else.
Autumn Pruitt and her husband moved back to Omaha and started a small bakery in 2010. Soon after subleasing a kitchen and tiny storefront from Aromas Coffee House, they purchased that coffee shop. In 2015, they began roasting their own coffee under the brand name Hardy Coffee Co., and later brought every piece and location of the business under the unified name of Hardy, Autumn Pruitt's maiden name. Since its first shop, Hardy Coffee has opened 3 additional locations and grown to nearly 70 employees today, with an ethos of striving to create connection in the community. Autumn Pruitt, welcome to Lives.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate that you shared with me that you're from Beaver City, small town in southern Nebraska, but tell me about your childhood.
You know, that is where I was born. I was only there for the first couple of years of my life before my family moved to Omaha. And so most of my formative memories and years were spent in Omaha, but I feel like I always had one foot in rural and one foot in urban Nebraska. And I think that really shaped the way that I approach people and the way that I approach conversations and the way that I approach so many pieces of life.
Tell me about your family context.
Yeah, my dad was a pastor growing up. My mom stayed home with my brother and sister and I until I started elementary school, and then she worked at the school. And so, a good, strong, connected family. I think that so much of my approach to hospitality came from the way that I saw that demonstrated in our home. And so we always joked that we should have had a couch in the kitchen. It was the smallest room of the house, but somehow that was always where everyone gathered. And so whether that was our immediate family or people from church, or that was people from the neighborhood, we were somehow sitting on counters and strewn across tables. And that's just where so much of life happened.
I think this will unpack a little bit as we continue our conversation. I am curious about this nature of identity and how we identify ourselves. And I'm struck by how you described your father straight away as a pastor, so someone that was ministering. I'm just curious about that, just because how we frame our context, our childhoods, how we identify ourselves, I think is really informative and influential in our lives. So is that how your family saw itself, as this kind of pastoral family that was in a sort of rich faith tradition where hospitality was a part of, as it were, the air and the water that you lived into every day?
Absolutely. And I don't know that you know to name it that when it's your childhood. That's just life. You know, you don't know that it's different from somewhere else until you get a little older. But yeah, I think that so much of the way that my parents shaped our home life was to be one of inclusion and welcome and hosting. And so we did a lot of that. And so there was a lot of food involved, because we just discovered pretty early on that there's just no more authentic way to bring people together than around really good food. And so my mom is a phenomenal cook, and that's how we spend a lot of time together.
I love how you've been using words like hosting and hospitality, and I can't shake that image of the couch in the kitchen, right? And how life was centered around that. How did that, could you unpack that a little bit more? How did that show up? For example, the genesis of obviously this later career in baking, for example. So how was that showing up in your household in those earlier years?
When we first moved to Omaha, it was to a church that was just going through a split. It was very divided. And we went from, I mean, as the story goes, of course, I was two. So this isn't a memory of mine, but I think that, you know, going from potlucks with lots of people and farm wives that were bringing in buckets of delicious things to the first Sunday in Omaha, where everybody scattered the moment that the sermon was over. And so trying to figure out, like, how do we set the table even as the new people? And I think that food is just a very human way to do that. And so you don't get to know each other until you get to spend time together. And it's not much fun to spend time together unless there's good food to eat. I don't know if it was intentional or if it was just something to say, like, this is something I can do. And so started in the most humble and average way by eating together. But if it's good food, then people tend to stick around.
I'm mindful that your family moved to Omaha. It was around the circumstances of ministering in a new church. But at some point, you did make the decision that you were going to leave this context, leave Omaha as a community to go to study. And I'm curious what it was that motivated you to depart that, what feels like, as you describe it, just such a warm, homely place, but nonetheless, you made a decision to travel to study.
I think hubris is maybe the right word. You know, I think it's when you graduate high school, I think you have a pretty good idea of what your future is going to look like. And for me, it felt like a really good opportunity to say, like, how do I stand on my own two feet? How do I prove myself? How do I do this in a place that seems interesting and adventurous and a place that I can do it without the support of my family around? So I decided to move 1,000 miles away and do it somewhere else. And I think that was good and formative too. But I think there's also this funny thing where you realize, like, oh, you never really do anything on your own. You know, there's always a support system. And so I think that hopefully I continued to get wiser as we went along. But I never regret leaving. I think that then coming back to Omaha was a real choice. I think that sometimes if you never make that leap, it feels like you get stuck. And when my husband and I made the choice to move back to Omaha, it was to say, we're choosing this instead of somewhere else. And when we both left Omaha, I think the idea was to be anywhere else. And it wasn't because it was bad here. It's just that everything else felt novel and interesting. And so the idea of Portland and the idea of LA and the idea of an ocean nearby and to be able to make our mark on a different food and beverage scene felt really interesting. And then you realize, like, actually, Portland has enough coffee shops. Actually, I think some of these other cities are pretty big ponds in a way that the idea of moving back to Omaha seemed like finally the right choice to say we could do that here with the support system. And he had an actual job. So that felt like a good job offer to create stability to try something new in my career.
Anybody that knows me knows that I am a total sucker for a love story. And so you've mentioned your husband, but I get the impression from how you've described this that perhaps you knew him before you traveled to college. What's the genesis of this love story?
Sure. You know, we actually knew each other for several years before we ever dated. And he and my brother went to college together. And so there was a connection there where we somehow just kept ending up in the same places. And so he actually did an internship at my church. He was a worship pastor there when I was in high school. Like, again, we just kind of kept running into each other. He finished his college career and got a job that happened to be at the church my mom was working at the time. So again, one more time, we're running into each other. And it was just this funny moment the summer after I graduated where we were kind of in the same spot and we realized, oh, wait, I think there's something here. And we had to make the decision, do we pursue this over the next 3 months before I move 1,000 miles away? Or do we say, oh, that could have been something? And so we decided to give it a shot. And we dated long distance for 2 years before we got married. And he followed me down to Tennessee while I finished school. I had a full ride scholarship and he had a great job in Omaha. And it was one of those things where it made so much sense to stay the course and to do life separately for 2 more years. But he never asked me to quit. He never asked me to come back. I think that that was the sign of like, oh, you love me enough to sacrifice something to do this differently and down here. And so, yeah, I think the 2 years that we spent apart from the support system one more time was actually really good for our marriage, for falling in love, for doing all of the things in a different place, and to make up for some lost time that we had long distance for the 2 years before.
You talked about some of the reasoning that you went through as to why coming back to Omaha made sense. But I do want to open that up a little bit more. What were the kinds of features of returning to Omaha that actually made that choice the one that rose to the top of your priorities and choices?
Yeah, I think it's helpful when you know the community and neighborhoods already, when you start identifying places that would make sense to start a business. To do that in a town that you have no context for feels really overwhelming. Both of our families are here still. And so the idea of being close to them, close to parents and siblings, to have my parents had promised free labor if we were to start the business back here, which any small business owner knows is really priceless. And I think for me, initially, like, we knew that we wanted to start the business, but I was actually just looking for a job in the industry initially. And so to start looking for a baking position to make sure that this idea of what I hoped this dream life would look like actually matched up with the reality of the day to day. So Luke had a job offer in Omaha, and it felt like the opportunity to say, like, okay, let's start there. And so that's what we did.
It sounds really inspiring to me that you had an idea, a vision, this big picture concept of what you wanted to create in terms of a business. I'm wondering where that vision came from. Is it from that couch in the kitchen? Is there some other sort of motivating genesis to this this business idea that you seem to have been nurturing for a while?
You know, I think that that's part of it. I studied business in college, and so I think it was the opportunity to put together a business plan to say, which of these ideas and dreams that I have could actually work? And so we had talked about like a bed and breakfast, maybe, or maybe it looks like a cafe instead, or maybe it looks like exclusively a bakery. And so I think having the opportunity to explore those ideas with professors and fellow students to say, okay, let's put pen to paper and present this idea to a bank and do some of those unglamorous motions, it just made it feel like, yeah, you're able to test some of those theories before it was real money.
I'm so full of admiration for anyone that can have a vision for something bigger than themselves and have the fortitude to pursue that vision. What is that alchemy that makes an entrepreneur an entrepreneur?
You know, maybe it's hubris again. You know, I hate to, man, you have to have like enough ignorance and maybe just enough arrogance to think I can do this differently than anybody else has so far. And as you get into it, you realize how many people you can learn from along the way and mistakes that you make, so many mistakes. But there has to be some element of, I think I can do this in a way that I'm not seeing done around me. And so I think I'd had lots of jobs. And I am very employable. Like, I think I could put together a pretty good resume most days. But there's this piece of me that says, this is what I want to do. And there's days that that's not the case. But I think that more often than not, you wake up and say, let's figure out how to build something that didn't exist before.
How do you go about bridging those days where you'd rather be doing anything else and those days where you realize that this is what you felt that pull towards for all those years and still do today?
I think that you have to figure out your mission and vision pretty early on and then talk about it often enough, so that on the days that you're not feeling it, that the people around you can remind you of what you said. I'm having one of those days right now, which maybe is entirely too vulnerable, but somebody who's been a longtime employee on our team, it was his last day today. And so it's just one of those hard days where you say, oh yeah, like like, this is my dream. It's not everybody's that's on the team. And so to have somebody else that says, it's just one day, and these are the things that we're moving past, and there's still a lot of people that are excited about what comes next. And I think it's okay to have the moments of grief and then to be able to recenter and say, okay, what next?
How do you navigate those instances where someone else doesn't seem to love this thing as much as you do?
Yeah, I think that that was something that was really hard for me initially. So like, this is year 14 of our business now, which seems crazy. You know, I was talking to somebody about that the other day, and it's like any long-term relationship where it's like, it feels like it just started, you know, it feels like it was only yesterday. And at the same time, you can't really remember life before it. And so we're kind of in that phase. But I remember, you know, I was my only employee for a while, and then there was two of us, and then there were three of us. And then, you know, it grows slowly and steadily. And the first time somebody leaves, it's that gut punch where you say, but this was our dream. This is what we've been working towards. And it's in that moment you realize that, and this sounds so fatalistic, but it's just realistic that everyone's going to leave. And that's okay. And so if you're building something that's going to last, that means that you have to figure out how it's not contingent on any one of us, including myself, and how you build something that people will miss if it's gone, and how you continue to bring more employees and customers and people along for that journey that can catch sight of it, but to also be open-handed enough that when somebody's ready to do the next thing, that you're not angry about it, and that you don't waste those relationships because they have every right to go do their next thing too. And so I think that that was much harder early on. And I think sometimes even people that have the very best passion for the business have to leave for worse, harder reasons, health reasons, or they're taking care of an aging parent, or they're leaving for reasons that they would rather not be true to. And so I think that I just learned as time went on to hopefully just be more grateful for the time that we had together, to lead a little bit more open-handedly, and then to be able to help them do their next thing, whether that's their own business, whether that's a different job, whether that's leaving to do something else entirely, and not to have them leave with a bad taste in their mouth. I think everyone's going to tell a story about their time at Hardy Coffee Company, and we have the opportunity to make that a good story on their way out.
You mentioned the word lessons, and I promise there's an upswing to this two-part question. But the downturn is, what's the worst experience, the worst thing you've done as an entrepreneur that you've had to learn from? And then we can talk about, you know, what's you know, the really positive lessons that you've taken away.
We had a location that didn't make it. And so at the very end of 2015, we opened our third location at the time. And everything on paper looked like it was going to just work so well. And so it was located inside of Flagship Commons, which is like the food hall at Westroads Mall. And it was alongside the folks at Flagship Restaurant Group, who are phenomenal small business owners. I don't even know if they're a small business anymore. They're just business owners, but like quality people that were generous and kind and invited us in to be part of that development. And again, everything on paper looked like it would work, and then it just didn't. It was one of those things where like we just couldn't own the space very well. And so it didn't feel like you were welcoming people into your coffee shop. It felt like you were welcoming them to a coffee counter, and they weren't in every day to buy coffee. They were in once a year to buy shoes. And it was just, it felt like this really tricky thing where our other shops were built on consistency and regulars and community. And we just were never able to make that shop feel that way. And it wasn't just about the feeling. We also couldn't make a cash flow. And so it was like the numbers told the story of what we were experiencing. And just for good measure, I also had my son, our first kid, in February of 2016. And so it was one of these moments where it was like life change upon life change upon life change that was happening. And we had to make the call. We tried it for 2 years, and it just didn't work. And to be able to say, this isn't working was really hard. It felt a lot like failure. And I think to say, if we don't make the choice about this location, we are going to lose the entire company. And so having to have that perspective, having to make hard choices, but I think the right choice, the humility that that brings to your life, I think is tricky. But that was a hard season.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. So what are perhaps some of the things that you've just hit out of the park? It just was the quintessential best thing you could do as an entrepreneur where everything just seemed to go right.
That is a great question. I think those are harder things to identify. I think that most of the things that you hit out of the park don't happen all at once. And sometimes the really hard things feel like they do, even though they don't either. So yeah, I think the hardest thing about success in the type of business we have is that it's slow, steady growth over time. And it's about grit, and it's about showing up every day, and it's not hitting it out of the park. There has to be a different sports analogy. Like I think it has much more to do with like marathon training than it does baseball.
And I especially like you talking about the idea of a marathon would be a better, if not exactly correct, metaphor. Because sometimes it feels as if you only realize you're being successful in hindsight. In the moment, you're just not aware of it because you're too busy doing or persevering, because you're running race, you're pursuing the dream, and it's in motion. So it's hard to see in that moment.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I even think it's in those failures that you're like prepared to do the next hard thing. I think that so much of the decision to close the location in 2018, which led us to be able to open our location at Highlander, which is in North Omaha, which is my community, the opportunity to move our roasting department there, our bakery there, it positioned us in a way to be as ready as anyone could have been for 2020. And I think that when COVID started, so many small businesses were saying, like, who am I if this thing disappears? And what happens if we have to close our business? And I think that we had already faced all of those really hard questions 2 years before. And so realizing that, okay, as hard as that would be, this isn't my identity in the same way it was then. This is what we do. It's not entirely who I am. Made the possibility to pivot in 2020 faster, to say, let's try this. Let's try this for now. Let's try this again tomorrow. Let's change it all the next day. And to be able to lead a team through that, hopefully better and faster, just because we had already wrestled with some of those bigger, harder conversations 2 years before.
I mentioned earlier the idea of identity and how we choose to see ourselves or see other people in the world. And I'm curious about how then you see yourself. So is it as an entrepreneur, a businesswoman, family member, community leader? And I'm sure all of these apply in some way, shape, or form, but how do you identify yourself?
Yeah, hopefully all of those. But I do think that it's hard not to lead with, hello, I'm Autumn Pruitt. I'm the founder and owner of Hardy Coffee Company. But also understanding, like, if that wasn't in my Instagram bio, that I would still be Autumn Pruitt. I just would be doing something else. This is what I want to do. And I hope that it continues to grow and create space for people as we go. But yeah, it's not the only identifying factor anymore.
When you decided to start this business, and as you said, it's been 14 years as we sit here, what was and what is the entrepreneurial ecosystem like here? You know, how have you found it and how have you navigated, you know, the contours, the textures of what that ecosystem is like in Omaha?
I think that initially I was so heads down in my business that I worked really hard every single day and did not look up. And you can do that for a while. And then a couple years in, I started feeling so lonely. And just, it was one thing when it was just me, and it was another thing when there was a team of people to lead. And there was a small group of women that reached out to me and said, like, would you like to grab dinner? You know, and again, connection around food. You know, it wasn't a lot of people, but it was the right people to have those conversations with. And it was women that were leading businesses of various sizes in completely different industries. But all of a sudden, you just didn't feel so alone in those things. There were conversations that people said, yeah, me too. And it didn't mean that they had the answers, but it meant I'm not the only one dealing with this problem. And I think that sense of community that happened early on, I am still friends with those women. And we don't see each other nearly as often as I would like, but there's still lifelines that we each reach out to. And I think that was the first step. And that really thrust me out of the nest in a lot of good ways. And by the time we had two locations, I think there's this sense of like, I physically can't be two places at once. We got a lot better at building systems and processes, got a lot better at hiring and delegating, and it created space for me to attend more networking events, to be out in the community, to not always have to be the one hosting that table, but to get to be a guest too.
I mean, I don't sit here and ask male CEOs about, you know, what's it like to be a man starting a business? And not to say that there aren't nuances to that too, of course there are. But the data suggests that it is more challenging to get a business going as a woman and to be perceived in the same way. And I'm just, without wanting to heap that upon you, and certainly not to suggest that you represent female entrepreneurs, but how did you encounter any difference in that regard? And does it matter? Did it matter to you?
You know, I think that there were several different tables where you're the only one that looks like you. And so that doesn't necessarily imply that you're treated differently, but it is just, it's the table you walk up to. I do remember one of the very first leases I negotiated for our downtown shop. I mean, I was 23 years old. I'm talking to this man twice my age that lives out of state that is really pressuring me to sign this lease. And I came back with 17 different questions the next day. And just his tone and the way that he came back to me, he said, are you sure you don't want to be a lawyer instead of a bakery owner? I was like, well, it was on the list, but let's go ahead and come back to these questions. And he said, you're young enough to be my daughter. And I said, I don't know that that's relevant in this conversation. You know, just some of those moments where it's like, I understand what you're trying to do with these questions, but I'm just stubborn enough to meet you right where you're at and push back just as hard. And I think that it took doing that a few different times for me to gain that confidence. He's still my landlord. And so we'd have those same conversations consistently. And now there's a very different tone. I think that you're expected to prove yourself, and I was up for it. So yeah, I think that there's some of that. But I think there's also so many kind and generous people. And I think that it helps just to assume the best. To assume, like, I'm going to do my very best not to take offense at every question you have. I'm going to assume that you're being curious and not judgmental. I'm going to assume that even if we don't agree on this thing, that there's probably a lot of things we could agree on. And how do we find consensus somewhere else? And so I think that's been the majority of my experience. And I bought a good blazer. I think, like, how do I show up to some of these meetings and feel a little bit more confident? And yeah, I think some of it, again, is that marathon. You keep showing up a little bit at a time every day, and people eventually take you seriously. And I think that that's true whether you're old or young, man or woman, whatever that looks like. It's this is the only body I've ever had, and so it's the one that I continue to show up in, and I just don't necessarily have anything to compare it to. But for the most part, it's been fine.
I'm not sure I like the phrase pay it forward, but nonetheless, you know, there it is. And you mentioned in the earlier days of your business that a group of women said, hey, would you like to come for dinner? And then you develop these networks and support groups and relationships. And you kindly share with me off air that you've had instances where you've been able to support others as they themselves have turned around to grow their own opportunities or businesses. And I'm just curious if you could share a little bit about the ways in which you have turned to others to perhaps offer the kinds of advice or support that perhaps you felt was missing for you at certain times, but also to, as it were, repay some of those opportunities and supports that you experienced because you benefited and you want others to benefit from that too.
Yeah, I think the best resource I have is just my experience to say I am an open book. And so I don't pretend to have all the answers for you, but this is what I've learned along the way. And this is who I would reach out to if you're having a hard time getting a loan. And these are the people that have been helpful for me as I've tried to develop a better strategy. Or these are people that I think you should know, either as potential customers or advisors. And so I think that those are the easiest and some of my favorite ways to connect with other entrepreneurs or people that are thinking about it. But yeah, we've had so many people on our team that have chosen the path of small business as well, and usually in a different industry. And so that's been fun too. I think I told you about Sharon Manhart, who was on our team. She was one of our coffee shop managers and was initially a tattoo artist, but ended up breaking into the sign painting world. And I think like every mural you see in this town has her influence on it and maybe her actual paint strokes. And so to be able to help her with whatever I knew at the time, to give her opportunities to say like, hey, would you want to do our menu boards for now? And now, I mean, she's booked solid. And so I have to say, if you could pencil in some time next August, we would love some touch-ups on our mural. And it's just been so rewarding to see the way that she has taken this vision that she had and turned it into a career. And so fun to be even a small part of that experience with her. Yeah, multiple people on our team that are figuring that out. And whether it's space that we have rented to them to say, hey, I know that you're just starting this idea, like Artemis Tea, who now has their own shop in the Blackstone District, like they worked out of our downtown kitchen for 3 years before they were able to do that. Cinti Gelato did the same thing. I know multiple people right now that are in the process of figuring out if they want to launch their own business, whether that's coffee repair or a different bakery. Like sometimes you're stepping on each other's toes a bit, but I think Omaha's plenty big to be able to help somebody else even in the same industry.
We've been talking a little bit about you and your life and your development as an entrepreneur and developing this business, but I haven't given you a chance to actually talk about the nuts and bolts of what is Hardy Coffee Company now. So would you mind just sharing a little bit about, you know, what is the business?
Absolutely. We say that at Hardy Coffee Company, we recognize that life is unbelievably full. And so we serve excellent baked goods and freshly roasted coffee in physical spaces around Omaha. So we have a shop down on 11th and Jones in the old market. That's where we originally started. That is exclusively a coffee shop now, but it's right on the edge of the old market. And so we get to be part of so many fun things that happen right there in the heart of Omaha. We also have a shop on 60th Ave and Maple. That's our Benson location. Our Highlander location is on 30th and right between Hamilton and Lake. That's on the Highlander development. That's where our bakery and roasting facility are located. And then we have a drive-through only location on 144th and just off I-80. So we opened that at the end of 21. And that was a whole new venture too. And so with our roasting department, in addition to roasting coffee for our own shops, we have about 60 wholesale accounts as well. And so those are other coffee shops and restaurants and offices that we get to roast coffee for. We say we like to help them serve excellent coffee with confidence. And so in addition to actually providing the coffee, we have a consultation program and we help them to reach that level of success faster. To say, if you knew about these obstacles ahead of time, how much quicker could you get to break even? And so again, doing our very best to teach people from all of the mistakes we've made along the way.
So there's some nuts and bolts and some of the what around what you do. I'm still thinking about that couch in the kitchen And I'm thinking about this idea of hosting and hospitality. And I think it was a sociologist, Ray Oldenburg, that coined the phrase third place. And so a third place is that place where we spend time that is not home and not work. So what is this why? What is this ethos, the spirit driving, the feeling of what you're trying to create at these places you've just described?
I think before 2020, we would have put a lot of stake in the physical place. That was what all of our language around our mission and vision was about curating physical spaces for our community. But then I think in March of 2020, we picked up the tables and chairs and customers couldn't come inside, and we had to reevaluate, who are we? Who are we as a company if we can't provide the physical space for people? What, like, and I think the funny thing is, I was actually just talking about this with somebody the other day, you know, like, I think that transition had already started. We had already started selling more of our coffee that people were brewing at home. We were doing more of our wholesale at that point anyway. Like, there was a significant amount of our business that wasn't about the physical space, but we had continued to talk as though it was. And then with 2020, we couldn't pretend anymore. And so it forced us to reevaluate. And I think what we came away with was to say that we want to help our customers experience rhythm and ritual and connection in their day. And so whether that's at one of our cafe tables or whether that's at their own kitchen counter where they are brewing a good cup of coffee to start their day, or if it's at our drive-thru where there's not a physical space to come inside, but this 20 minutes while you're driving to work with a great cup of coffee creates a rhythm that you can enjoy, that you can still breathe deeply, that you can reconnect with yourself before you walk into whatever's ahead. And so I think that is more our why now. And honestly, it probably was before, but that is what we talk about all the time now.
When you shared with me earlier the experience of having the venue at Flagship Commons that didn't work out for you, as you describe this spirit of what you're trying to create with Hardy Coffee, it almost feels inevitable that that particular venue, a Flagship, wasn't going to work because it almost couldn't fit that brief that you've just described.
Yeah, I wish you had been around when we were really trying to decide if we'd do it or not.
It's only because you just shared that with me that it makes sense in hindsight.
It does. And I do think you need to find those moments and places of rhythm and ritual, whether you're in a crowd or by yourself, whether you're working at the mall or if you are going on a walk, you know. And I think that at our best, like, we're able to create that moment of connection with our customers behind the counter and to pay attention to the details, but to help them feel welcome and connected, and then provide a product that is genuinely good that helps carry them through that next however many minutes of ritual before they hit their next task.
How do you see the relationships, the rhythms, the connections, the rituals that you've been creating with your staff? Because it's grown from you, one or two people, and now you're around 70-ish employees. I'm wondering how you have try to develop that same feeling of extended family with your staff.
I'm really careful not to call our staff family. I think that expects a different level of commitment than they should or we should have to provide. I think it muddies the water when you talk about reviews and compensation and time off. And in my younger days, when it was so hard when people left, it was because I wanted them to be like family. And the reality is that we're a really good team. And if we can maintain that language instead, then I think that it creates better boundaries and expectations. That being said, we've got such a good team. And I think it continues to get better when I don't try to hold it together myself. And again, when you go from one location to two, you feel a lot of those growing pains. And I think that that was a pretty sticky spot where I was still trying to be that person for everybody. How am I your direct report? How am I touching base with everybody? How are we having these conversations? And the reality is that that oversight and management and direction just doesn't scale like that. It can't with one person. And so the more that we trust our managers to be that person for their team, the better it is for everybody. And so we work really hard to pour into our direct reports and to figure out exactly what that is, to figure out what the rhythm is for connecting with everybody on the team to say, okay, we're going to still have team meetings with all of the baristas at every location quarterly, but we're going to trust and require that our shop managers are checking in with their team members consistently. And we are doing the same for them. There's going to be one-on-ones every week. There's team meetings with our direct reports. We're making sure that we are very well connected with the people that we work most closely with. And that's the expectation from there too. And when you hire well, and when you set clear expectations, and you can trust that that's happening.
One other relationship that you shared with me that I thought was interesting was that your husband obviously had a hand in the business, but this was your business and you founded it. But recently, relatively recently, he exited what he was doing, which was being a minister, to come on full time to the business. I'm just curious about what were some of the conversations you had about making that choice and then navigating the fact that you were now both, you had a relationship outside of the business, but also now you have one within the business too.
Yeah, and we don't pretend that that would work well for every couple, but it's working well for us. And it's been such a relief to be able to do this business together. You know, I think that he is one of the most talented, capable people I know, and to be able to, again, that delegation piece, I feel like sometimes because everybody else is going to leave at some point, you like don't completely let go of some of the things because you say, if I need to pick that back up, I need to make sure that I don't miss a step when I do. And so I'm going to like, this is your thing, but I'm still very well connected to a day to day. And when Luke came on full time, it felt like this just relief to say, okay, I trust you completely. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be a learning curve or things that we need to continue to figure out whose responsibility it is. But he came on part-time in 2021 when we were launching our drive-through location. We were approached with that opportunity and it felt like a great choice, but I didn't have the bandwidth to oversee that construction by myself at the time. It was one of those things to say, I think this is right, but we're only going to do it if you're up for it too, Luke. And up until that point, he was always associated with the business, but he didn't have any authority when he would walk into a shop to say, I don't know if that's the way that this is supposed to happen, or can I show you how to do this? He was always the repairman that would come in under the cover of night to fix the espresso machine or, you know, snake a drain. But he has so many skill sets to offer even during the day. And so it's been so nice to be able to do that together. So we came on part-time in 2021, worked part-time for two full years before we decided to go all in. And so I think that that was this really nice runway to make sure that, again, this thing that we have in our brain that we think is going to work, how does it actually feel in the day-to-day? And so we're plugging right along. And I think that we're finally in a really good rhythm where he is our chief operations officer. He oversees our brick and mortar shop managers and how the shops look and feel every day. I oversee sales and marketing, which includes like our roasting and bakery component as well. And then we do a lot of things together.
You shared what is clearly a faith-based context to many aspects of your personal family life. And I'm wondering how any aspects of that context around your faith beliefs influence or show up in the business at all?
I hope that they always show up in the way that we treat people, in the way that Luke and I show up to those tables and rooms. Sometimes people ask if it's a Christian coffee shop, and I frankly don't know what that means. Like, I think that I am a Christian, but coffee is just coffee. And I think that we want it to create teams and places where everybody feels welcome and invited, and that they can contribute well and not feel as though our faith is a barrier, but hopefully that it's always an invitation. And so I think that we try to live our lives in such a way that reflects that, but that the shop itself, like the company itself, is a for-profit business that we hope has good financial principles and a great product. I think sometimes people hide bad product behind a mission, and I think that that's dangerous and not what any mission is for. And so for us, like, we want to be the very best coffee shop in Omaha, and we show up every day to do that with the team that we have, and hopefully more along the way.
What have you learned about yourself over these decades of being raised in the way that you've shared, going off to study, making the choices you have, establishing and growing this business? What have you learned about who you are?
You learn so many things that you don't know. I think, like, I was so confident about so many things until I got into it. And now I think I have a little more honest idea of my abilities and expectations. But I also think I've learned that I can do hard things, and I can do difficult things over a long period of time. I've developed much more patience. I think I've developed much more grit. Like, I think I show up now not just because I'm too proud to fail, but because I'm committed to the people I get to do it alongside. I also think, like, we were dangerously close to burnout a couple years ago after all things COVID, and my husband and I would wake up every morning and run hard in opposite directions towards two very good things. And I think so much of the decision for him to come on full time wasn't choosing between, like, a good thing and a bad thing. It was choosing to say, like, if we're going to create any margin in our life, how does that happen? And so I don't know that we're there yet. We're still trying to find that margin, but it's weird to talk about faith and, like, on a microphone, because I feel so anxious that I'm going to say something that doesn't resonate or that I wish I could take back. But here we are. We're doing this thing. We're in the room. We both have a microphone. So I think so much of the last 2 years was to right-size the role of church in our life, to say that, like, for us, it's not just about this Sunday, Wednesday showing up congregational experience that has a place. But for us, like, being an apprentice of Jesus looks a lot more like also making space for silence and solitude, and also making space for rest, and also making space for fasting, and making space for these ancient spiritual disciplines that somehow just get lost in the busyness. And I think maybe the other thing that I'm learning as an entrepreneur, is that I'm learning just as a person, is that, like, that sort of pace that we set for the first dozen years, it's just not sustainable, and it's not healthy. And you don't see the people around you the way that you should if you're always rushing. And so for us, like, this shift isn't just so that we can chill out a little bit. It's to, like, become people of even greater love. And that only happens if you walk slowly enough to pay attention.
Honestly, I think that's just a really beautiful reflection of how you've intentionally evaluated your lives and made some really positive choices to do the next right thing.
Yeah, that's the goal. And I think when we have these tiny humans that we love so much, a son and a daughter that are 8 and 5, and you realize just how much they are paying attention and they care a heck of a lot less what you say and a lot more about what they see and the time that you're able to spend with them. And I think that that's a good motivator too.
It sounds as if from an early age, you had a sense of this big picture, this vision, this concept, this drive to fulfill this business idea. And you've been doing that. And I'm just curious, given what you've shared, if you're sitting in a place now where you feel as if either you've achieved a purpose and or if you still feel you're living into your purpose, you are still living into a meaningful life.
Yeah, I don't feel like we've arrived by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that we're building a life that we want to live, which I think if you're not careful, like you can be very successful, but build something that's not for you. And I don't know how successful we are, but I think that we are building something that is for us.
My guest today has been Autumn Pruitt, the founder and business person behind Hardy Coffee Co. Autumn, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Lives is brought to you on KIOS Omaha Public Radio and is produced by Courtney Bierman. The music you hear playing in and playing out is performed by Andrew Bailey. Podcasts of today's show and others can be found at livesradioshow.com or where you get your podcasts. Subscribe today and please leave a review. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. Join me next week as we delve further into the practical and profound possibilities of living well. Thanks for listening.